Hi. hello, everyone, and welcome to Wednesday. I'm here, of course, for the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And last week, we looked at Ramana's cinema show analogy for the true self, the mind, the world, etc. And I'm going to go back to that a little bit before I continue, because even though when I was sharing it, I thought it was kind of a tough intellectual teaching. I might have commented a few times that I felt it was too intellectual for me. The truth is, it didn't let go of me. I continued to contemplate it all week. And so I just want to go back just a little bit and just share, as far as I know, just one thing with you. And then we'll move forward. But before we do anything, I want to play a song. Now, I just want to tell you, in case the sound sounds a little different today, that I'm sitting upstairs. I'm not down in my office. So I don't have my speakers and all that jazz. But what I'm going to do is play a song. This song is by Xavier Rudd. It's called Follow the Sun. Follow the Sun. And I'm going to play this song as our opening song before we start looking at the teachings of Ramana Maharshi. So, here we go.
Which way the wind blows when this day is done. Breathe, breathe in the air. Set your intentions. Dream with care. Tomorrow's a new day for everyone. Brand new moon and brand new sun. Place. Many moons have risen and fallen on
before you came. So which way is the wind blowing? What does your heart say?
See a couple of people here who were not here last week, and so maybe it does well just to do a little bit of explanation. Was that Jamie? Did you hear something? I didn't hear Jamie, but I was really engrossed in the song, so maybe. Oh, I think the dog crying was not a dog crying. I think that was a funny native instrument in the background of the music. They had a funny native instrument. Yeah. Jamie walked by a couple of times, but I don't think she made any noise. If so, I didn't notice it. Last week, when I was looking at the spiritual teaching of Ramana Maharshi, we looked at his cinema show example. And he said that if you think of the old movie projector, which in his time was the current movie projector, so the word old I'm adding. But you remember the old movie projector, which is a film strip that ran through the projector and then it projected the film onto the screen. He said that the lamp on the, I'm glad you love the noise it makes, because we're going to be listening to that noise in a minute, Cheryl. That's a part of my plan. We're going to be listening to that noise in a moment. he said the lamp inside, the lamp inside the projector is like the self. And the lens, on the, you know, there's a light, and then right on the outside of the light, there's a lens. And that lens takes the little bitty pictures on the films and projects them to make them look really big on the screen. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to see the movie. So he says the lens on the outside of the light is like... is like the pure sattvic mind. I guess there's two. And the lens with the light passing through it, which once it also passes through the film, creates those big images. The lens with the light passing through it, he said, is like the mind. The film, of course, is like our latent tendencies, which are actually get projected. And the various pictures on the screen are like the world, right? This entire example. And we went through all of this last week, so it's not my intention now to go through it again. It's just that after I finished that teaching, one part of this stayed with me. And the part that stayed with me was that the lamp inside the projector is like the true self. And that lamp shines through the mind, right? It shines through the mind. But the lamp itself is the true self. And the way they stayed with me is I found myself, you know, several times over the last week, just kind of sitting quietly and pretending that I was a movie projector, that I was the actual machine. And as a living movie projector, hold on, I gotta take my shoes off. When I sit comfortably in my house, my shoes start feeling too tight, and I don't know why I didn't take them off before, but there. Okay, they're off. Now we can be comfortable. I sat pretending that I was a movie projector, And of course, the mind again is the lens, and any ideas in the mind are the film. But I found myself really searching for the light that shines through the lens and through the film. And I found it to be a very useful little imaginary practice. I think if you're in gentle healing, you know, lately I've been talking about playing games that make us aware of awareness, right? Well, this was just another game that came to me from after last week's teaching. So what I thought I would do is I would play the sounds of an old projector. And while I do that, we can each just kind of close our eyes. We'll have kind of like a brief meditation where we close our eyes and we notice any ideas in the mind, any thoughts in the mind as the film strip. We notice the mind itself as the lens, but we look for the light. You imagine yourself as a projector and look for that light that is the self. So I am going to play film strip sounds while we do that. So this audio is only 30 seconds long. So I might play it a few times. But again, close your eyes. Imagine yourself as a projector. And look for the light that shines through the lens and the film. Okay, that was the 30 seconds, and I want to do this with you, so I don't want to have to keep replaying it. So what I'm going to do is go back and look for, I think I can find a longer one. Here's one that is a minute and 10 seconds long, so this is a little longer. So again, any thoughts you see or the film strip? The mind is the lens that makes those thoughts seem kind of big and important. But we're looking for the light that shines through the lens and through the film. And we are the projector. Here we go. Am I the only one that had fun with that? To me, that's great fun. It's great fun to play that little game. So for those of you who are playing awareness games, that is another one that you can play. You know, you can go on YouTube, and we might do it one more time before I move on because I do enjoy it. But you go on YouTube, you can just type in film projector sound, and a few will come up. And again, the first one was 30 seconds long. This one's a minute and 10 seconds long. So we get a little more game playing, a little more meditative practice out of this one, which I'm going to play one more time, and then we'll just move on. But again, this is a brief 1 minute and 10 second meditation where we are imagining ourselves as an old-fashioned film projector, reel-to-reel film projector. Our thoughts are the film strip. The mind is the lens that really gives attention to those thoughts, makes those thoughts seem big and important. But the light, awareness, is that which shines through the lens and through the film strip. And so what we're doing as we look at ourselves as a reel-to-reel film projector is we're looking for that light. So let's do it one more time. Here we go. I do like doing that. So, and Cheryl has given a link for film projector sound in the room. If anybody wants to continue playing that little game, it's a fun little game. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to continue forward in the book, The Spiritual Teaching of Ramana Maharshi. And I'm beginning at the bottom of page 25 with question number 14. The question here is, what is dhyana? And then in parentheses it says meditation. And so what I want to say before we even go into the answer to the question is that the translation is interesting. And I'm going to trust that the translation is accurate. And, of course, we'll find that out as we look at the answer to the question. But I'm going to trust that the translation is accurate. But the word dhyana, D-H-Y-A-N-A, D-H-Y-A-N-A, is typically translated as devotion. And so it's interesting that here it's translated as meditation. Because what that says to me is that at least in Ramana Maharshi's experience, meditation and devotion are the same thing. You know, some people look at meditation as a firm discipline. You know, I've heard stories. I've never practiced Buddhism. But I've heard stories from people who have practiced Buddhism about going on, you know, at least some, I'm sure not all Buddhist retreats are this way, but going on some Buddhist retreats and the master is walking around with like kind of a whipping stick. And if your posture begins to slouch or something, you know, he kind of gives you a little smack. So that you straighten up your posture. You know, so that's what I mean by a discipline, kind of a, you know, has a fierceness to it, right? A fierceness to it. So for some people, meditation, I think, is a little hard. And what I'm reminded of right now is Michael Langford has a video on YouTube where he talks about how 1 hour of meditation from the heart is worth more than 1,000 hours of meditation from the head. You know, so what he's calling meditation from the head, I think that's that harder, I want to say flatter because it doesn't have any feeling to it, that harder, flatter, sterner, more aggressive type of meditation. No fun. In fact, I remember when I was interviewing Ellie Ruzdar, she said that meditation cannot be a chore. That was the word she used. That's a good word, a chore. So I think a lot of people think of meditation as a chore. And so it's interesting that the word devotion, you know, devotion implies love, you know, really big love, in fact. You know, when if you've ever felt the feeling of devotion, it's a very big, all-consuming love. So the fact that Dhyana, which is typically translated as devotion, is being translated here as meditation, to me that tells me that meditation is more like the loving consciousness method. It's meditation with the heart. It's meditation with love. In fact, in my calendar, you know, I schedule in meditation time, which is important for me. But what I notice is... what I do before meditation is I do 30 minutes of reading. And the reading opens up my devotional heart. I noticed that before, there was a time when I tried doing meditation when I felt more pushed for time. Like I don't have time for a lot of fluff because of the work I have to do. I want to do the meditation, so I schedule the meditation into my calendar. I sat down and I closed my eyes and I meditated and I did want to be doing it. You know, nobody was forcing me to put it in my calendar. But when I went directly to the meditation in that way, it was like meditating from the head. And now I still have it in my calendar. You know, my whole life is run by my calendar. But I have added 30 minutes of reading prior to the meditation. And of course, I'm always reading things that I feel spiritually guided toward. So what I find is that the reading opens up the heart. So by the time I put the book down and I close my eyes to go into the meditation, it is a devotion. And in fact, I typically... hold. I like to hold things in my hand. So I typically hold either, I have a rock, a heart-shaped rock that Michael Langford gave me when I was at his house. And the story that came with that rock was, you know, he has to walk to the end of his driveway. It's a pretty long driveway, actually. He lives pretty far back from the road. So he walks down this long driveway pulling his trash, you know, once a week to take the trash out, leaves the trash at the end of the driveway so the trash people can come and get it. Then at the end of that day, he walks all the way at the end of that driveway and pulls that trash back to his house. You know, he did this every week for 17 years, he says. And then one day he happened to glance down and notice this heart-shaped rock in the driveway. But it had probably always been there. But for 17 years... you know, we call it four times because you've walked down the driveway and up the driveway in the morning. That's two times. Down the driveway and up the driveway in the evening. That's two more times. Really walking up and down that driveway four times a week for 17 years, he never noticed the rock. And he said that's the way most people are with the true self. It's always there, just like that rock was always there in the driveway. But they never notice it. And so he gave me the rock as a reminder to pay attention to the true self, to that little light that we just paid attention to in the projector. So sometimes when I meditate, I hold that rock in my hand. And then I also have this lovely, lovely, lovely rosary that I got in Santa Fe at this church where they have this miraculous circular stairway. And I don't remember this story exactly, so I may be a little off in my storytelling here. But I don't remember why they needed a stairway and a balcony. But this little church needed a stairway and a balcony, but the church was so small, there wasn't really space for a staircase. And they didn't know how they were going to solve this problem of a stairway and a balcony in this tiny church. And so this carpenter just kind of showed up. And this carpenter built for them a circular stairway that doesn't have a center pole. You know, most stairways, they have the center pole, and the pole is what holds the circular stairway up. You know, the center pole is the foundation, and the circular stairway is built around it. This stairway is just stairs going in a circle without a foundation up to this balcony. And then the carpenter just disappeared, and nobody ever really knew who he was or where he came from. Some people think it was Saint Joseph the carpenter, Jesus' father, or your stepfather, I guess. But the stairs, you can still go and see the stairs to this day. And, you know, and architects say those stairs shouldn't be, you know, they shouldn't be able to stand like that without something to hold them. And of course, they don't let you walk on those stairs anymore. They're very old, but you can see them. So in that lovely, lovely church, I found this beautiful, beautiful rosary. And I bought it in this little miraculous church. And sometimes I hold that in my hand. But my point is that meditation for me is a devotion. It's not a chore. Right? I read first, which opens the heart, and then I grab either the heart or the rosary, which, you know, I feel great devotion towards. And I close my eyes and I go into meditation. And it feels very, very right in that way. So, again, all of that just came from the fact that they are translating the word devotion, the word that is usually translated as devotion, dhyana, translating it into the word meditation. So the question is, what is dhyana? And again, the question is translated into, what is meditation? And here's the answer. It is abiding as one's self without swerving in any way from one's real nature and without feeling that one is meditating. As one is not in the least conscious of the different states, waking, dreaming, etc., in this condition. The sleep noticeable here is also regarded as dhyana. Ah, oh, that's so sweet. So, what Ramana Maharshi is saying, of course, is that if we abide as that unaffected self, abide as awareness all of the time during our conscious waking hours, that our unconscious sleeping hours also count as meditation. If that's where our attention is throughout the day when we're consciously aware, then our attention naturally goes there at night as well when we're unconsciously aware. Now, I understand this answer very well. Again, the question was, although it's translated to what is meditation, the actual question was, what is dhyana, which means devotion. And a while ago, I defined devotion as this big, all-encompassing love. If you are devoted to someone or something, if you are devoted, It just means you're 100% in. You're not devoted if you're 80% in. You're very committed, but you're not devoted. Devoted is 100% in with love. And so when the question is, what is Diana? The answer is, it is abiding as oneself without swerving in any way from one's real nature. I'll stop there. We'll look at the rest of this in a moment. But you can hear the 100% in. Now, of course, I spend, as you know, some time every day in sitting meditation. And I've just talked about how I go into that. But I have many, many more hours per day when I am not in sitting meditation. And I know that Ramana knows that. That's not only true of me, that's true of most people in the world. And so when Ramana says that Diana is abiding as oneself without swerving in any way from one's real nature, I don't think for a moment that he expects us to get out of bed, sit down in meditation, stay in meditation, you know, 12, 14, 16 hours, and then get up and go back to bed. I think that he means that as we're going about our day, whatever our day entails, that we are making a conscious effort to abide as the self without swerving in any way. So, you know, somebody yells at us, tells us what for. We continue to abide as the true self. Our attention is focused with awareness and intuition. Our attention is focused in that way inward. Although, you know, during a waking state, you can't be focused 100% inward. You know, you're looking out to even hear the person, whatever it is that they're saying to you. But for my response, for how I am to be in this situation, my attention is inward. Before the thoughts. You know, if we think of the projector image, if I'm the light, the film strip, which is the thoughts, are outside of me. I would be looking out to see my thinking. How should I respond? I'm not looking out towards the thinking. I'm looking in towards the heart of the light, the core of the light. And I'm doing that not because I'm looking for guidance from an other, you know, like an inner Jesus or an inner Ramana or a Holy Spirit. I'm doing that because that core is myself. And I want to be myself, not the false self of the thoughts. Not the false self of the conditioned reactions. I want to be myself. Myself is found in that inner core. And so I tune in to my inner core and I make sure that every word and every action is coming from there. And that's devotion. That's 100% in. So the sentence continues, what is Diana? It is abiding as one's self without swerving in any way from one's real nature and without feeling that one is meditating. So that's an interesting statement. Maybe there is a slight a slight mistranslation. Who knows? When the question, what is Dhyana, is translated as what is meditation instead of what is devotion, and then the answer says, without feeling that one is meditating. I have recently come upon a word that is a Sanskrit word that I had never come upon before. It may sound a little familiar to you. It's Nisarga. I'll type it into the room. Nisarga. And in fact, I saw it written in this way. Nisarga Yoga. Now, the reason Nisarga may sound familiar is because one of the teachers that I pay particular attention to, so you may have heard me speak of him, is Nisargadatta, right? Nisargadatta Maharaj. And I haven't looked to see if Nisargadatta's name comes from Nisarga Yoga, but I think it's highly likely. I just don't know that for a fact. Nisarga Yoga is natural living, which means living from the true self. Natural living, living from the true self. So when Ramana Maharshi says that devotion is abiding as oneself without swerving in any way and without feeling that one is meditating, it reminds me of this Nisarga Yoga. You know, when you feel like you're meditating, again, you're setting time out. I'm going to say it this way. You're setting time out away from your usual way of being in order to meditate. But if being aware of the self and abiding in the self is your usual way of being, then you no longer feel like you're meditating. You're just being your natural self. Natural living. Nisarga Yoga. That's 100% in. That's devotion. So we're not talking about the 2 hours in the morning that I set aside for meditation. When Regina stops being Regina for 2 hours and closes her eyes and focuses in a devotional way on meditation. We're talking about the body of Regina. Not living from the Regina mind at all. But living from the heart of the self. And that being perfectly natural. That's devotion. What is Dhyana? It is abiding as oneself without swerving in any way from one's real nature and without feeling that one is meditating. As one is not in the least conscious of the different states, waking, dreaming, etc., in this condition, the sleep noticeable here is also regarded as Dhyana. Okay, so question number 15. What is the difference between Dhyana and Samadhi? The answer is Dhyana is achieved through deliberate mental effort. In Samadhi, there is no such effort. All right, so I'm going to go back and correct my answer to the previous I stand corrected. Although I think everything that I just said to the previous answer is still helpful for those of us who walk about in our daily lives, staying inwardly focused, living as the unaffected self, becoming very natural in that practice is extremely helpful. I don't think that's what Ramana is talking about here. And the reason I say that is because the next question is comparing dhyana to samadhi. Samadhi. Most people think of samadhi again as you know, if you see a master in samadhi, which is completely lost in the self, having absolutely no body or mind awareness, no world awareness. They typically think of the master in a sitting meditation type of position. But Ramana Maharshi and other masters have talked about being in samadhi even as they, you know, appear to move about. Samadhi being, in that case, the state of no mind. It's the body moving about in the world after the final death of the ego. And so the one, I don't know what to call this one, sage is typically a word given to them, but the one who previously appeared to have a mind and a personality and see a world, no longer has a mind, although there may be a personality there, they are not that personality, and they do not see a world, and that is samadhi. It's a, you know, at the very, you know, for lack of better words, it's extremely advanced, the most advanced state of awakening that we are aware of for humans in the world. And so the question here is, what is the difference between dhyana and samadhi? And the answer is, dhyana is achieved through deliberate mental effort. In samadhi, there is no such effort. In A Course in Miracles, it talks about, you know, how, you know, through forgiveness, you can reach true perception. But in order to go beyond perception entirely through the gate of heaven, it's God that takes that last step, right? God takes the last step. So when Ramana Maharshi says that with samadhi there is no such effort, you know, this is like going, you've already passed through the gate of heaven. The ego has already come to its final end. It's the experience of nirvana. And there's no effort in that. But he says that dhyana is achieved through deliberate mental effort. Yeah, samadhi, Kathy, that's the correct spelling. So, dhyana then, I believe, would be still, it's devotion, so we're still talking about with the heart. But I think it would be what we call meditation, which was how this was translated. The first question, what is dhyana, what is meditation? It would be setting down and closing the eyes and practicing with the heart, awareness watching awareness or self-inquiry until body awareness and world awareness is lost and you're in what appears to be samadhi. The difference being that it's not permanent. So through meditation you can have these experiences which people often call like glimpses of awakening or glimpses of the true self. But then you come back to body awareness and world awareness. That's Diana. And that, again, requires a certain amount of effort. You know, we sit down, we close our eyes, we practice self-awareness practice, whether it's awareness, watching awareness, loving consciousness, self-inquiry, whatever. We practice self-awareness practice, and we become skilled in that practice to the point where we go into pure awareness, no body, no world awareness, no subject-object awareness, pure awareness. But it is temporary, and we return to the subject-object awareness. That is a daily practice. That, you could say, requires effort. But again, he told us in the very first question, what is Dhyana? What is meditation? He said it's abiding as oneself without swerving in any way from one's real nature. So now, with my new understanding of this, he's talking about, well, I'm sitting there, abiding as the self, I don't let my attention wander off to my thoughts. I stay with awareness. It is abiding as oneself without swerving in any way from one's real nature and without feeling that one is meditating. That he is talking about then the specific, I'll use the word stage, the specific stage where we go into that pure awareness. Once you're in that pure awareness, without subject-object awareness, there isn't going to be an I there meditating. Right? It's a different state of awareness. So Dhyana, devotion, is again, it's still 100% in. But it's when we go into our awareness, watching awareness meditation so deeply that we lose the awareness of a self meditating. We lose the awareness of a body. We lose the awareness of a world. It's just awareness, aware of awareness. That's what he's calling Dhyana. And then he's saying that since you're not at all conscious, as one is not in the least conscious of different states when you're in Dhyana, because when you're in Dhyana, there's no body, there's no world, there's no I. So what's the difference between awake and asleep? So he says, when you're in Dhyana, since you're not the least conscious of the different states, like waking and sleeping, etc., in this condition, that the sleep then is also regarded as Dhyana. So if you happen to be in that deep, deep state of meditation and the body goes to sleep, it's still Dhyana. And although I have never gone into this deep, deep state of meditation. I have not gone that deeply. However, I have had an experience many times. I think you guys have heard me say that I used to fall asleep during meditation. And what I learned to do when the sleepiness would start to come over me is I learned to ask the question, you know, who is it or what is it that sees the sleepiness? And I learned to pay attention to the awareness while the sleepiness was happening. And I learned to get to the stage where the mind could go to sleep and dream. You could literally drift off into sleep. But I remained aware because I was focused on awareness. It was very interesting. And so from that, what I would imagine, and I've got to be very clear on imagining here because I haven't had this experience. So please know that I could be wrong, right? But what I imagine here is if you're in this state of Dhyana then, you know, if you're sitting there, you know, for 12 hours in a state of Dhyana, the body may at some point go to sleep. People may walk by and hear snoring. But you're so focused on awareness that you are literally beyond the body's states of being awake or being asleep. Again, I've had my own experience of that, so that seems entirely possible here. So let's look at these two questions again together and listen to the answers, because again, it's a slightly different perspective than the one I started with, although I still think for those of us walking around in the world, it's extremely helpful for us to be intertuned, focused on the inner self, you know, speaking from that inner self rather than from the personality, acting from that inner self rather than the personality. And that I'm still going to call is a form of devotion. But he's talking about something that I have not ever achieved, something beyond that level of meditation that I've gotten into. He's talking about going into a deep state of losing all awareness of self and world. But he says dhyana is doing that temporarily. Samadhi is when you have crossed over the threshold, and that is now your existence. So the first question, question number 14, what is dhyana, meditation? It is abiding as oneself without swerving in any way from one's real nature and without feeling that one is meditating, as one is not in the least conscious of the different states in this condition. The sleep here is also regarded as dhyana. Question number 15. What is the difference between dhyana and samadhi? Dhyana is achieved through deliberate mental effort. In samadhi, there is no such effort. The next question is pretty long. So I'm going to look at the first little part of it just because we have about, 7 minutes left. But we're not going to be able to finish this. So next week when I come back, I'll need to start with question number 16 again and go forward. It's funny, I'll just comment on this. I've noticed that the two books that I am now teaching from, other than the Seven Steps to Awakening on Sunday night, but I'm teaching from this book, The Spiritual Teaching of Ramana Maharshi, now, and then at night, on Wednesday night, every other week, I'm teaching from I Am That with Nisargadatta. I notice that these two books are really, really stretching me. For example, in this teaching, I misunderstood a question and answer until I went to the next question and answer, and then I needed to go back and correct myself. Last week, I taught about the cinema show, and I taught it, but I wasn't loving it while I was teaching it, and then it stayed with me all week, and I found myself pretending that I was a projector. These two books are really stretching me. And, if I say that out loud for any reason, it's because I have certainly heard people say to me, people who teach in the sanctuary, not all people, but some people, they're uncomfortable grabbing a book that stretches them. Maybe because we use the word teaching, they feel like they should really have the book under their belt. They should really know it very, very well. And then they can come in here and teach it, right? But my feeling is, then you're limiting yourself. If you are teaching what you already know, what's the benefit? Yeah, I know, as Kathy says, I prefer the stretch. I prefer the stretch too. I mean, to me, that's what teaching is. We use the word teaching, but teaching is all about stretching. The teacher, stretching the teacher. Right? So definitely, those of you who teach in the sanctuary, I encourage you grabbing a book that stretches you. Now, there could be some books that are just entirely so far over your head that you can't possibly stretch to them, That can certainly be at certain levels. But if you're always, setting like a, I remember when I was in the corporate America, when we sat down and we set our goals for the next year, and we're going to be paid our bonus based on whether we achieve our goals or not. Everybody wanted to set these safe goals that they knew they could achieve because they wanted to get their bonus, right? And the rule was, the corporate rule was, it had to be a stretch goal where you stretched yourself in order to achieve that goal. It was more than you'd ever done before. And so we were always having to check people's goals and make sure they were stretch goals, more than they'd ever done before in whatever their job was. And really, that's the way we should be selecting the material that we teach in the sanctuary. And it's okay if you do what I just did and say, you know what, I got that wrong. I now see. Let me go back. Let me look at this again. You know, don't let your ego lie to you and make you think that you should in some way appear perfect, or that you have to appear that you know what you're talking about. You know, I always think of teaching as an out loud contemplation. It looks like I'm probably not going to read 16 since I'm doing this little bit of talking, but that's okay. I'll look at 16 next week. But teaching is just an out loud contemplation, which means you don't have it all figured out. You don't know. The clarity is coming as you're sitting here and giving your attention to it, and interestingly, in front of witnesses, but not in front of judges. And in fact, that's one of the reasons that here in the sanctuary, we don't allow the criticism of the speaker, because we want the speakers to be comfortable speaking about what they don't know, comfortable awakening live in front of supportive witnesses. And of course, most people, if you all were sitting there, you know, typing in things like, golly, Regina, you didn't even know what you were talking about. Why are you bothering trying to teach this book? You know, if most people, that kind of criticism would shut them down. And therefore, they would not continue the stretch teaching and would not continue the spiritual growth. So our sanctuary, as you know, is set up for supportive, non-judgmental witnesses. Safe. Sanctuary, that's what the word means, sanctuary. And if somebody does happen to come in that begins the criticism, we have paid staff, Cheryl and Ken, who are paid, to follow procedures, red dot the person, that kind of thing, you know, to make it safe as quickly as possible. So please be willing to find the material that you feel guided to that is your next stretch. Again, you don't have to take material that's so far forward for you that, you know, that it's just not, it's not a stretch. It's way too much. It's just way too much. You know, but find something that stretches you. I always teach what stretches me. And I always have. And that's why I continue to grow, develop, mature, awaken, however you want to word that. So there, I guess that's what I ended up talking about. Don't be afraid to make a mistake while you teach. God bless you. We love you. And next week, I will start number 16, and we'll see where that goes. All right. I'm going to be hanging out and listening to Anne. Bye.